on DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
Five Live.
Friday afternoon, so we'll have a movie conversation. Mark, we're still on holiday.
How long has he been away for then?
It's about a couple of months.
But this is a man who's a workaholic.
I know. He's very twitchy and he's certainly listening somewhere.
Hi Mark, hi Mrs. Mark, hi Mini Marks.
And next week, he's back next week, but brilliant. I think he's speaking to us from the Shetland Islands.
Why is that?
He's curating, he and his wife are curating the Shetland Isles Movie Festival.
Fantastic. You should take the whole show up there, do an outside broadcast.
I think someone said that it was too expensive. I think that was the general idea. But it's nice to have you back, James.
Thank you very much.
Traditionally, of course, regular listeners will be aware that James always gets left a bum week.
Yeah.
But it's not too bad, actually.
No, I mean, basically, the summer blockbusters are over. This week, we really see that as we move into September, that the blockbusters, which were happening once a week, sometimes two a week over the last couple of months, have finally come to an end. So we have some interesting stuff this week. Not big stuff, but interesting stuff.
Before we do the top 10, which we're doing in just a moment, do you think it's been, as some people said, a death? Some of our emailers a few weeks ago were saying, what a desperate summer it's been. And yet, movie companies have been saying, actually, if you look at the blockbusters, it's been fantastic.
Well, it's the age-old problem between looking at the box office figures and looking at the reviews. Which ones do you actually take as, if any of them, as the gospel truth? As a film fan, I think it has been a bit sad. I've been underwhelmed by a lot of the sequels. They've been fine. I don't think there's been any major turkeys. I probably go to Pirates of the Caribbean to talk about something I really didn't like. But the other ones, Shrek, Spider-Man, Die Hard, I thought they were all fine if good, but very few of the big sequels, and that's what everyone was talking about this summer. The big sequels really blew me away. The ones I've liked the most, actually, there's still a couple in the top 10, have been the original films.
Okay, well, let's do the top 10 with reviews coming up for, amongst others, 1408, Breach, and Hallam Foe, and Death Sentence. Anyway, the top 10 this week at 10, Hey Baby.
Which is a Bollywood remake of Three Men and a Baby, which itself was a remake of a French film called Three Men and a Cradle, which got me thinking about how filmmakers around the world are obviously heavily inspired by the story of three guys who can't change nappies. We're now on the third version of it. I haven't seen it. All the reviews I read have been telling me that it's astoundingly, overwhelmingly average. Doing big business, but average.
Hairspray at number 9.
Now, you see, now we're talking about some of my favourite films of the summer, and Hairspray has actually been one of my favourite films of the year. It is, of course, a huge, stupid, silly, mainstream, fun movie on the face of it, but what I think is great about it, and of course great about the stage play upon which it's based and the original film version that was based on, is that it does have this subversive side to it. It is silly, it is sing-along, you can listen to the soundtrack and they're doing a sing-along version at one of the cinemas in London. You can do all the stuff you do with Sound of Music and Grease, but it does have a plot which deals with racism, which deals with size, which does have this quietly rebellious side to it as well, which is what I really, really like about it. I just absolutely adore this film.
Number 8 is Surf's Up.
Which does have a bit more invention in it than your average animation. It feels a bit looser than the others. I think you get the sense that the actors weren't just locked in recording booths on their own. They did actually interact a little bit, and it has this mockumentary style to it about penguins and this surfing competition. Ultimately, like, when I see things like this, and I think even the film companies releasing it know this, you're just waiting for the next Pixar movie, the next big Disney Pixar film, which actually comes out in October, called Ratatouille, which is infinitely better than Surf's Up, which is fine, but really you're waiting for the classics, and Ratatouille is a classic.
Brat at number 7.
Now, I've been on holiday, Simon, and I did try and catch up with a lot of the films that I missed.
You don't have to catch up with Bratz.
Bratz wasn't one. It would look really odd now. I'd go and see it for free at a press screening, but to go and pay for a ticket and to go up to somebody and say, I want one ticket to Bratz, and to go and sit there surrounded by the rest of the Bratz audience, I think I would look a bit weird.
You're not a target audience, are you?
I'm not. So I was a bit embarrassed to do it. I would like to see it just for completion's sake, but I haven't, so I don't know.
Transformers is at number 6.
I know that Mark's talked about seeing this as well, but one of the many things we talked about after seeing it, you know, he said to me, James, you went for two toilet breaks during that. That's unusual for you. And I just thought, well, if there's any film that I would still be able to understand despite having two toilet breaks and missing several minutes of it, then it's a Michael Bay film about cars that turn into robots. Michael Bay made his name directing videos for Meatloaf, and every day I look to the heavens and pray that he will return to directing videos for Meatloaf and leave the cinema alone.
Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, this week's number five.
It's Imelda Staunton's movie, I think. I think she's absolutely brilliant in that, but for all of them, I think it's a big improvement. I mean, I like the last one as well, the last two, in fact, but I think they're getting better and better. So best of the bunch so far.
And I should mention, Daniel Radcliffe is going to be on this programme in the next couple of weeks talking about his new movie, The December Boys. Number four, Simpsons movie.
Perhaps it's not as funny as the 25 minutes in terms of jokes per minute quota, you know, but I just think that any film, especially one that's made as much money as this, which features a romance between a man and a pig, is, you know, is, you've got to pat it on the back for just being as cheeky as it is.
Spider pig
indeed.
But don't you think all the best jokes are in the first half?
It feels like three Simpsons episodes, and the first half does have the most amount of jokes, and perhaps it's not as funny as all the expectations were for it to be, but I do think that it's still funny.
Rush Hour 3 at 3.
Which I think is, I can barely even speak about it, to be honest. This is one of the ones
The poster says it's their finest hour. Are you telling us that we're being misled?
That's not credited to anybody apart from Brett Ratner, the director, a man who, you know, who thinks that breasts are still the most amusing thing in the world, and he's aged 38. The only good thing I can say about it is that Chris Tucker doesn't make many films. I presume he's very lazy. He makes about one film every 4 years. The downside is that they are normally Rush Hour films, but we don't have to put up with him very often.
Knocked Up, this week's number two.
Which I think has got big laughs, big heart, a big running time too. It could have done with a bit of trimming, but on the whole, I think this is just a really great, fun, warm-hearted date movie.
And it's not number one because The Bourne Ultimatum is still lodged fairly firmly.
Now, when I was going back to talking about the summer and talking about some of the sequels I thought being a bit underwhelming, I don't include The Bourne Ultimatum, which just blew me away. It's just this lean, mean, angry, tough action film that I think is the best of the three. I think it's one of the best action movies I've seen.
And just to repeat what Paul Greengrass, the director, said on this programme in the middle of the let's see how many jokes we can make about Tottenham sequence that he did with Matt Damon.
And how many did he do?
Well, absolutely loads. It was 15 minutes of it. And he said at the end that he will do another Bourne film, because, of course, anyone who's seen it will know that there doesn't need to be.
Yeah.
There could be, but there really, really doesn't need to be. He said he'll do another one if Spurs finish in the top four.
So he's not going to do another one then?
Well, it's not likely, but it was, you know, it's still a huge promise to make given the amount of money that would be involved in making that movie.
Bourne on the 4th of July. There we go.
The Five Live Football Daily. Our latest podcast. Rounding up all the football news, interviews and discussion you could possibly need in a convenient, free downloadable package. Find out how to subscribe or get an individual episode at bbc.co.uk/5live. The 5 Live Football Daily. bbc.co.uk/5live.
Victoria in Liverpool says, you're talking about the three men and a baby,
yeah,
James, because Hey Baby, the Bollywood remakes at number 10. She says, I think the French Three Men and a Baby was itself inspired by the John Wayne comedy western Three Godfathers, which also seems to be the inspiration for Ice Age.
Wow. We've got another link in the Three Men and a Baby chain.
And that's probably, you know, I seem to remember when that film came out, it was considered by some in various parts of the United States as gay propaganda.
There's also a big web rumour, and it was a rumour at the time as well, about a ghost appearing in one of the scenes. It isn't a ghost, it's a cardboard cutout of someone, just to preempt anybody texting in saying, is it a ghost in Three Men and a Baby?
No, that's already been sorted out. Okay, so we've given you the top 10. What's new, James?
No Reservations is out. Any film that begins with a line like, there's no greater sin than to overcook a quail, is always going to have problems with me, especially when it's purred in that weird sort of Los Angeles via Glamorgan accent that Catherine Zeta-Douglas, Darling Buds and May, whatever, has these days. She stars in this. She plays Kate Armstrong. Kate Armstrong is a top New York chef. She's a very uptight kind of character. She likes her life run like a military operation. No chill out time, no love life, until her sister comes to visit her. She crashes her car, she dies. She Catherine Zeta-Jones then has to look after her niece, Zoe, played by Abigail Breslin from Little Miss Sunshine. So all of a sudden, this woman who, as I said, runs her life like a military operation, has to not only look after an 11-year-old girl, she has to take time off work, which she doesn't like doing. When she goes back to work, she finds that there's a new chef in her kitchen, and not just a new chef, he's this really wacky, crazy chef called Nick, played by Aaron Eckhart, who, for the purposes of the film, is meant to be lovable and likeable, but actually, because he wanders around in his wacky, loud trousers and sings opera, I just found him really irritating, but that's not the point. We'll get onto that in a second. So there's this woman who likes her life serious, who likes her life simple, and everything is going crazy. And she has to put up with lots of annoying customers in the restaurant as well. Now, you look at the poster of No Reservations, and you think romantic comedy. There's Catherine Zeta-Douglas, whatever, beaming nicely, and there's Aaron Eckhart next to her. They're both in their chef's whites, beaming, laughing. You think, what a lovely, charming, romantic comedy
this is
going to be.
Yeah, it looks like a still from Friends or something like that.
It doesn't have the first idea what it wants to be. The first half an hour or so is incredibly depressing, downbeat, really earnest. It makes, like, Schindler's List look like a romantic comedy compared to it. It's much, much moodier and takes itself much more seriously than you expect. Made worse by this endlessly plinky-plonk piano music. Oh, feel sorry for me. Awful, awful, awful. And then in comes this Aaron Eckhart character who's, hey, I'm so wacky, everybody, aren't I funny? No, you're just irritating. Catherine Zeta-Jones is meant to be warmed by him, is meant to be warmed by the fact that her niece now lives with her. Catherine Zeta-Jones can't do warm. She's about as warm as a fridge in this film. She can do tough. If you watch her in Chicago, which she won an Oscar for, I like her in that. She can do that kind of tough-nosed, steely character. When you're meant to like her, when you're meant to fall in love with her, as you're meant to do with lead characters in romantic comedies, you have a problem. And that is the main problem with No Reservations. This is based on a German film called Mostly Martha. I don't know if anybody out there has seen it. I haven't seen it. Apparently that's good. I think we should all now investigate the original version of this film called Mostly Martha and watch that one.
It doesn't sound very Germanic.
It doesn't. And Germany isn't known for its romantic comedies, but I hear it's a very good film. So let's go and investigate that one and not worry about this American remake, which is all over the shop, doesn't know what it wants to be, and when it is trying to be funny, it's not even funny.
How long are you supposed to cook a quail for, then?
I'm sure she actually does say that in the opening line, but I switched off.
Right, so, but it is possible. I don't know how.
Just to balance
have you ever
out.
Had it?
No.
Never
I'm
had
a
quail?
Vegetarian, so I don't eat quail.
Oh, right, that's rather disappointing.
Quail's eggs I've had, which are very small. You're not interested in this.
No, no, it's just if that's considered one of the major crimes, yeah. I'd just be intrigued to know how much is too much if one finds oneself cooking a quail.
Any chefs listening, I'm sure they can inform us.
I'm sure they almost certainly will. Mayo@bbc.co.uk. What else you got?
I think just to balance some of these reviews out, if I have time, I have sort of looked up to see what other people think of them as well. And one review
what,
of...
Excuse?
No, well, I just
what
think...
balance? Looking for other people's opinions? Well, we're not used to that.
Well, no, it's just because on the poster, there is a quote saying how brilliant it is. A delicious rom-com to make your mouth water, which is from Country Life magazine. So although I hate it, and I suspect you will too, Country Life magazine, love it.
Just got a recipe here for quails with...
Is that what you've been looking up?
Quails with cherries. Okay, and preparation time is 20 minutes, but the cooking is 40 minutes.
Okay, it doesn't seem worth it, really, does it?
No, and if they're not bought oven ready, you have to pluck, draw, clean and singe them and put salt in the stomach cavity of every fowl.
Yeah, this is why I'm a vegetarian.
Okay, sorry about that. Anyway, I think I've answered the question.
2 Days in Paris is also out. Judy Delphi wrote this, she directed this, she stars in it, she edited it too, and she did the music. I'm a big fan of Judy Delphi myself. You might have seen her Before Sunset, Before Sunrise, the two films she did with Ethan Hawke and the director Richard Linklater. She co-wrote the latter of those two. And like in that one, like in Before Sunrise, as the film title suggests, 2 Days in Paris is set in the French capital. Not much happens in it, really, but a lot of people sit around and talk about their life and talk about their loves and talk about lots of philosophical things that apparently as soon as you go to Paris and it's in a film, you have to start doing. Adam Goldberg co-stars in this. He plays Judy Delphi's American boyfriend. And if it is about anything, it's about these two characters, the French girl, the American guy, rocking up to Paris to see his in-laws, to see her family for the first time. So it's about him meeting her family. It's about meeting lots of her friends, getting pretty freaked out by the culture clash of America and France. and just him enjoying being a tourist in Paris as well.
More liberal Hollywood stuff.
Now, even though not much happens in this, even though it is sort of self-consciously quoting other films and influences and name-dropping, it does have a really laid-back charm to it. And most of the reviewers are name-dropping Woody Allen, are saying it's a bit like a Woody Allen film, in that all these people, you know, wear their hearts on their sleeves and talk about art and books and philosophy. And that is a bit annoying at first. I normally find it a bit annoying in Woody Allen films. You just have to get into the zone, really, to appreciate it. And when that happens, I actually really liked it. Adam Goldberg, the guy you heard in that clip, is very funny. He has the best lines, the quips about the French, the quips about Americans, the paranoia about his girlfriend's family, about his girlfriend's friends. He is basically Woody Allen in jeans in this film. So, as I said, it's slight. It's very, very small. It's very personal. Judy Delphi not only did all that stuff that I mentioned before, but her family are in this film as well, playing her real parents. But it does have a small, slight charm to it. And one of the quotes from the other reviewers, I've got Kirsty Lang from BBC Radio 4's Front Row, who is on the poster saying, "Wear waterproof mascara for this movie. I laughed until I cried."
Yeah, she
agrees with me, Kirsty.
Yeah.
Although my girlfriend's a makeup artist and claims the waterproof mascara doesn't work, so...
Does it have, as all these films seem to insist, a very rude hotel concierge?
It has a rude taxi driver, instead, which, according to Julie Delphi, who's a native of Paris, all Parisian taxi drivers are very rude.
Cook quails, though, with bacon and cherry tomatoes is only 30 minutes.
Again, it's of no use to me.
But if you're cooking a quail, you don't want to overdo it. You start. That was the initial challenge.
I'm starting to think that you would actually like No Reservation, starring Catherine Zeta-Jones as a chef.
Well, on that subject, Joe, listening in Chicago, says, my family and I saw No Reservations a few weeks ago while my daughters, aged 15 and 12, were sceptical, thinking this was going to be another Raising Helen or Uptown Girls. We actually enjoyed it. It's much in the vein of music and lyrics. It's not trying to be anything more than it is, which is just a simple little romantic comedy. Anyone walking into the film expecting more will be disappointed. The only strange part of the movie was when Catherine Zeta-Jones slips into her Welsh accent while she and her niece are playing Monopoly.
Yeah,
keep up the great work.
She does do that. But I think it needs to be more than what, you know, what I'm saying is I think our expectations of it are just to be a romantic comedy, but it's not romantic enough or comedic enough. And actually, she mentions music and lyrics. I was dreaming of Drew Barrymore and Hugh Grant in this film. If only they had been in it, it would have been a lot better.
Andy,
but hello to our American listeners.
Yes, and hello to Jason Isaacs as well. Andy Killey and David Morrissey.
Yes, and I know the Harvey Keitel story.
Okay, you know it as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
One of your producers was just asking me to reveal all, but I said no.
No. If you do see Mark or you do see James, there is an extraordinary Harvey Keitel story which won't be broadcast or podcast, but they might tell you.
Yeah.
But only in private.
Yeah, Mark tells it better than me.
Andy Killeen says, "I've seen Mostly Martha, which you were talking about earlier. I'm sure it's better than the Hollywood remake, but it is a very slight piece, and I wouldn't encourage people to cross the road to see it." David in Barcelona, "Mostly Martha's not good. It's wonderful. I recommend it for everyone. It has great soundtrack composed mainly of Keith Jarrett music, and is," he says, "the best German film for years."
Okay, what about Lives of Others? That's brilliant.
Well, he's put it alongside Goodbye Lenin on there.
What a very international audience you have to
85058. So, what else have we got?
1408
John Cusack.
Is John Cusack, based on a Stephen King short story. And it's about a horror writer called Mike Enslin, played by John Cusack, who is secretly cynical about the supernatural. So he goes to supposedly haunted places, haunted houses, to try and experience the other side, but nothing happens to him. Until he goes to the Dolphin Hotel in New York, and he checks into room 1408, because this, he is told, is a genuinely haunted room. Now, the manager of the hotel, played by Samuel L. Jackson, warns him not to go there. He says, "Please, I beg of you, I will give you a different room. Don't go into 1408. But he does anyway. And after a while, in that room where he gets locked in, weird stuff starts to happen. He has visions of his daughter, who he lost tragically a couple of years previously. He injures himself, the door locks, he can't get out. All goes very surreal, very claustrophobic. The special effects team completely go to town. Now, the majority of this film is just the John Cusack show, a one-man show.
Which is good for me.
Absolutely, good enough for me. It's him trapped in this room going slowly crazy, because what you get when you have John Cusack in a movie is that slightly befuddled, oddball personality, slightly ramshackle personality. To see him genuinely lose his marbles in this very claustrophobic atmosphere is fantastic. The special effects are a little bit over the top. I think they go too far, because what you have when you do go all out with the CGI is it's very impressive, but it doesn't necessarily make it as scary as it could be. I think if you hold back a lot of the time, that does make it even more haunting. This doesn't hold back at all, and the story ultimately is hokum. The twists and the turns in the story don't particularly work, but you watch it for John Cusack, and he is good enough, he holds the screen enough to make this worthwhile. I think it's probably more of a DVD film than a cinema film, and I think for horror film fans especially, you're going to want the extras on the DVD, you're going to want the commentary on the DVD, that kind of thing, which obviously you're not going to get at the cinema. And I don't know whether it just has that urgency to make you go and see it at the cinema.
It sounds like it could be a setup for Scooby-Doo. A Scooby-Doo episode, and you know, and then they go behind the scenes, and it turns out it's some old guy in a mask
with a projector.
Yeah,
yeah. It is hokum. The story is silly, but the main thing to know about it, and the main reason to go and watch it, either at the cinema or, as I said, wait until it comes out on DVD, is because you want to see John Cusack do his stuff. And I love John Cusack, even in dodgy films. He is still watchable, and this is one of those.
The past record of Stephen King's short stories is pretty good, though, isn't it? Shawshank Redemption was one.
Yeah.
Stand By Me, Green Mile.
Yeah. It's not up with them. No. It's not as warm or as nostalgic as those movies. As I said, it's more about the special effects than the actual tale. And I think Stephen King wrote this almost as a project, really, to show pupils how to write short stories. And then he sort of develops it into a proper short story. So I don't think even he thinks it's one of his best short stories. But it's okay. But it's not up with those ones.
6 minutes to four. This is Five Live. Got a couple of big movies to fit in before we finish. What's next, Jay?
Yeah, Breach is based on the true story of America's biggest ever spy scandal. It's about a junior FBI operative called Eric O'Neill, who's played by Ryan Phillippe in this movie, who is assigned to shadow his boss. His boss is called Robert Hansen, played by Chris Cooper, who is this well-respected FBI officer. He's about to retire, but secretly he's under suspicion of selling secrets to the Russians. So O'Neill has to try and catch him red-handed doing this, at the same time, obviously, as appearing to be this innocent, helpful assistant. And even O'Neill has his doubts. You know, he's battling with his doubts about the whole investigation. Now, it's a deliberately calm, collected, perhaps a little distant type of film. You really notice that about the mood from very early on in the film. But it's reflecting very much this guy, Robert Hansen, the way he operates. He's very methodical, a real perfectionist, and obviously the way that the whole FBI operates. But because the film is icy to begin with, it is cold to begin with, when it does slowly start to reveal things and you slowly start to find out more about these two characters, Robert Hansen and Eric O'Neill, then it does have a real impact. So I think a really well-judged tone to the film, really well-paced film, and two great performances. That ruthlessness, that coldness might put some people off because it's not big and loud and obvious, but actually the seriousness of it, the earnestness of it in a good way, is something that I really liked about it.
What was interesting talking to Chris Cooper about it was that he says we never really, and he'd studied it and read all the books about it, never really quite understood why he did it.
Yeah, and the film doesn't want to give you easy answers. It does tell you some suggestions of why he wanted to do it, and it does slowly drip feed you information about this guy, about this double agent Robert Hansen. But it's certainly not, well, this is why he did it, end of story. It does like to leave things a little bit mysterious, which I think works.
One more film.
Yeah, Hallam Foe is the story of a very odd guy. He's the Hallam Foe of the character of the title. He's played by Jamie Bell. And Hallam Foe is a teenager with issues. It's mainly to do with his mother's suicide, the fact that his dad has just married his secretary. This screws him up, and this results in him doing some strange things. He likes to spy on people, a peeping Tom. He likes to camouflage his face. He likes to wear his mother's dress. And ultimately, he's had enough with his family, and he runs away to Edinburgh, where he falls in love. Who does he fall in love with? Someone who looks just like his mother. Now, the director has said, look, I wanted to make a movie about someone odd. All of that plot I've given away, you're thinking, well, this guy sounds really screwed up. He wanted to do that film. He wanted to make a film about an outsider, about someone who doesn't fit in. He has done that. Jamie Bell is brilliant at that kind of role. And it's not as perhaps universally appealing as some films it might be compared to, like Trainspotting, but it does have a really small-scale charm to it that I really liked. And Jamie Bell is just fantastic as this weird, creepy guy.
Movie of the week.
Hallam Fogg.
James King, thanks very much indeed.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.